I'm going to make myself vulnerable and tell you that there are three things I want to say to you before I talk about the topic. And if I tell you there are three, I'm bound to forget at least one of them. One of them is that the big round rolls of hay are out in that meadow now and will be there for a while. And this may be the last fall you'll get to see them. That's a possibility. So enjoy them because they are beautiful. The second thing is that the organ is a building in New York. Our first payment of something on the order of $30,000 should be coming due any moment. I want to reassure a number of people who have said to me that they were concerned about this, that the organ will not squeeze out the quiet loveliness of the piano in this room. We have no intention of having that happen at all. And the third announcement, and I am pleased that I made it, is that there will be an induction of new members into this church on the 18th of September. We will have two inquirers classes. You needn't attend either one, and you certainly would not want to attend more than one, but I'm going to have one on the 7th and on the 14th for anybody who needs a makeup. So for those of you who have already expressed an interest to me in joining this church, please keep those dates in mind. And if you're present and you would like to know more about this church, please plan to come to one of those meetings. You make no commitment at all by coming. I think that my experience with studying the Bible has been the exact opposite of what some of my fundamentalist friends would have predicted. They tend to feel that if one does not read literally, that if one admits the contradictions and mistakes which show up occasionally, one will have less and less regard for sacred literature. My experience has been the reverse. I am more fascinated by the Bible than ever. It makes excellent sense to me that the world's finest scholars should spend their entire lives mastering Semitic languages, Koine Greek, comparative religions, and interpretive skills in order to know what the Bible is and what it says. When I was a literalist, I had very little notion how great a piece of literature the Bible is. Great not because the people who wrote it were passive instruments taken over by some supernatural force to write exactly what God wanted written, as I thought then, but great because it was written by people like us, people with our same hopes and fears, who spoke straight out of their hearts, who wrote on parchment or vellum what they truly felt, even if what they felt was heresy. Like Ecclesiastes, for example, or most of the book of Job, a magnificent drama, rather hard to read because it explodes the images of poetry around your head like confetti from a ticker tape parade. And most of that poetry erupts from the heart of an anguished man who has found that the religion he was taught does not fit the facts of experience. That the God who ought to be comforting him is hidden somewhere and probably cannot be coaxed out of hiding. According to this masterpiece, most of which is obviously made up in order to sharpen its point, and it is not difficult to demonstrate that to students, there lived long ago in the land of Uz a man who was rich, God-fearing, blessed beyond all of his neighbors. His name was Job, and he owned a huge plantation. His barns bulged. His sons were 7, and his daughters 3, both perfect numbers in Hebrew storytelling. His flocks increased every year. His money multiplied. His reputation grew until he was the most important man in the whole country. And then suddenly, for no reason he knew about, his world collapsed. He was stripped overnight of his wealth. His barns were burned. His cattle were stolen. His children died. His reputation vanished. He was smitten by a loathsome disease. His wife told him to curse God and die. He could have made sense of it if there had been some fault on his part, but there was nothing in his life to deserve such treatment, and he knew it. His religion had taught him that if you are good, God will invariably bless you. He has been good, and now he has been cursed above anyone else on earth. The universe has turned upside down. Nothing makes sense. And out of his puzzled heart comes this poignant cry, as old as history, as fresh as this morning: I waited for the light, but you sent darkness. I called on you, but you did not answer. Why do you hide your face? This is not some idle literary exercise. This is not someone who wants to write a book that will shock people. This is the authentic cry of a man who tried to do everything right and saw everything go wrong. And lest you should think Job is unique, let me remind you of the words Amy read a little while ago from one of the Psalms. How long, O Lord, will you hide yourself from sight? And from another, why do you stand afar off and hide in times of trouble? Religion, let's be honest about it, is at once the greatest comfort some of us know and at the same time the greatest puzzle. Why, if God loves us, does he seem so remote? From out of the city, Job said, who had looked around, the dying groan, but God pays no attention to their prayer. You wonder why some editor did not cut that from the Bible? I think I know the reason. The editor had felt the same way. The Bible plumbs the depths of human hearts with extraordinary honesty. If you were to ask me, how are you different in your thought life from what you were as a boy or even as a young man, my answer would be quick and firm. I am overwhelmed as an adult by the dissonances of human life, by the pain and disappointment that come into so many people's lives for no logical reason. The college student who left his apartment to go to commencement exercises at the end of his brilliant academic career, winner of one honor after another, with a wedding set for the day after commencement, and an excellent job to start the week after that, and on the way, the brakes of a parked truck fail. It rolls down a hill, broadsides his car, and he dies during the night. If it had only happened to Hitler before the Holocaust, before the invasion of Russia, but Hitler was spared to cause 25 million deaths, and this young man was not. How does one make sense of that? I think of two remarkable people who years ago fell in love, were married, and created a home as gracious as I have ever entered. They were eager for a child, awaited their firstborn with the keenest anticipation, and it was a Down's syndrome child. I think of the first funeral I had in a ministry in St. Louis, when Margaret, 24, tall and lovely and the mother of two beautiful children, died slowly and painfully in Barnes Hospital of cancer. Just one more in a harvest so grim and so frequent that one would weary of the counting. Good people, desperately needed by families, the foundation stuff of clean and decent cities, hit by malignancy, robbed of a child, crippled by a stroke. Over and over, I have been in the room in the last hours. I know why Job asked where God was hiding when the dying called his name. But these are sensational cases. I've come to be even more impressed by the commonplace ones, so easily overlooked, but around you every day, every minute. One day, not long ago, I sat for a few minutes in a pizza place for two slices and a salad. Part of what one does in those places is people watch, and I was doing that. A young boy caught my eye, one of the waiters, probably 16 or 17, but very small and thin for his age. His face was wizened like that of an old man. He wore thick glasses. His shoulders were narrow. He had no physical strength, no muscle. Two other kids were at work around him, a healthy boy and girl, and they were flirting with each other. I saw them laugh at him once behind his back. He was alone in that place, and I knew he had spent a lot of time alone. I said to Billy, "Can you imagine what that kid would give to have broad shoulders and a handsome face, to be extroverted and confident, surrounded by buddies who really like him, able to get a date when he asks for one?" She always tries to find some comfort in these things. So she said, "Well, He's probably smart. Typical remark from a teacher, I think. I said it's possible. But even if that's how he compensated, right now and for years to come, he'd probably trade every A he ever got for the things he's missing. And I believed it. It was in his eyes. All we have to do is look sensitively to know how much undeserved anguish is in every house, on every street. But there is something that may be worse, and that is all the blasphemy and the profaning of the good that goes unpunished. I remember a moment from my history book, and that British sea captain, Sir John Hawkins, who sailed his ship along the African coast, kidnapping blacks to sell to the slave trade. When he captured them, he chained them to the deck of his ship, and then he christened his ship the Jesus. And God did nothing. Surely you can understand, at least, why Nietzsche said, God is dead. He spoke to us, but he is silent now. All we touch is a corpse. Why, Job asked, are you hiding? The Bible is incredibly honest about the eternal dilemma and torment of life. Man searches for God. God hides. One remembers Jesus himself in the darkest hour of his life, calling out to the God he had defined as love and asking, why have you abandoned me? We're not always in that mood, of course. We get the job we wanted. The lab report comes back negative. Life fills up with sunshine and song, and it's easy to think God is close and smiling. Even if we have a little doubt about it now and then, we may feel secure enough to make a joke. So Woody Allen says, if only God would give me some clear sign, like making a large deposit in my name in a Swiss bank. But there are other times when we feel lonely and scared, and we want as desperately as Job or Jesus to be reassured. Emerson says the preacher has to turn his life into truth, has to transform the stuff of his own experience into stories that shed light on our struggle to believe. So I remember these two moments. A night when her mother was away at the hospital with a baby brother. And Karen was a little girl, not quite sure what had happened or how her mother was, and who wanted to sleep in the same room with me. I wasn't much surprised when, after the lights went out and it was quiet, she said, Daddy, are you there? I said quickly that I was. And a few more minutes went by before she asked the question out of the darkness that made a little parable for me. She said, Daddy, is your face turned this way? The history of religion is the history of people who launch that question into the darkness at the God who seems to hide. And there was another moment of parable in my life with another child. It was in the daytime. Devin was 5 years old. His mother was away in school, and I was reading and working in my office. I could hear the happy noise of his play for about an hour and a half. And this has probably happened to many of you. All of a sudden, it stopped as if someone had turned a handle. The silence made me listen, and I knew right away that he had become aware of how long it had been quiet from anywhere in that house where I might be. I could literally feel his alarm mounting in that silence. And then I heard his voice. It was only one little sentence out of all our years together, but I will never forget it. A shaky little boy's voice, not yet in total panic, but headed that way, launched into the apparent loneliness of that house in the form of three trembling, high-pitched words, "Is anybody here?" I've spent my life looking for analogies, because that's what a minister has to do, to light up the dilemma of faith and doubt. And that moment, long ago in our house, became for me a metaphor of our own cosmic question. We play, we imagine great things, we work busily for a while until a moment comes when silence falls and loneliness intrudes, and we are fearful we may be utterly alone. And then, not in words perhaps, but at least in the voiceless language of the heart, we call out, "Is anybody here?" There isn't enough logic in all the world to prove that somebody is here. But there have always been people who thought so. I happened last week to be reading the words of a man who once listened to Admiral Richard Byrd tell about his journey to the South Pole. On one of those trips, Byrd had set up an advance base 200 miles beyond the main depot where he lived alone for his scientific and psychological research. He almost died from monoxide poisoning, and he suffered from anxiety and depression until he wondered if death might not be a blessing. He wrote about it later, and he said this about something that happened to him at 3 in the morning. The sleeping pills were on the shelf. The flashlight fingered the bottle. I reached for the bottle, but then I stopped. It was impossible to go on like this. I found a match and lighted a candle. An unused sheet of paper lay on the bunk. I wrote, "The universe is not dead. Therefore, there is an intelligence there, and it is all-pervading. Though I am cut off from human beings, I am not alone." He put out the candle, slipped into his sleeping bag, repeated the words over and over, and fell asleep. despite all the unsolved riddles and the questions we cannot answer, we are together in this place because we insist on believing the same thing, that we are not alone. It is not an easy faith for people who are both honest and intelligent. But as a brilliant modern writer puts it, and you must listen very carefully to this sentence, the only theism worthy of respect believes in God not because of the way the world is made, but in spite of it. Think about that all week and come back.